Yeah. We got it out.
So why are you guys here? Well, us at Gearbox, we really like doing user testing. We care a lot about our fans and the quality of the products that we make. So I want to ask you guys a couple questions before we go into that. Who plays games? Ooh, lots of you. How many of you have played BioShock? How about Mass Effect 2? Fallout 3? Borderlands? How many of you guys think that Borderlands is the best game of the ones that I listed? So we knew that you guys were going to do that. We just tested you, but there was a flaw in our process. We knew that our audience was going to be biased. You came here to hear us talk about Borderlands. If we worked for BioWare and we asked you the same question about Mass Effect, you would have likely given us the same response. Because you want us to feel good. You want to make us feel good about ourselves. You want to be nice to us. So understand that when you're testing, the people that you're testing with and the information that they have about you and your product can bias the results. So why are you guys really here? Well, there's a couple of reasons that we think that you're here. We think that you've either done user testing and you're interested in seeing what Gearbox does different. We think that you may have not done any user testing and you kind of want to see what it can do for you. You're a fan of Borderlands, or you want to get into the game industry. Does anyone not fall into one of those categories? So we didn't account for you.
Why are you here? Okay.
Well, we actually didn't account for your specific reason for being here, so you would be an outlier. Now that we know why you're here, we can account for you next time, and we can better develop our process for when we do this again.
Well, back in June 2008, we did our first Borderlands focus test, and it was off-site. It was not at Gearbox Software. It was at a focus test facility, sort of. And when we went in two different cars. One group of designers and programmers and developers went in one car. I was in one. The other guys went in the other car. In the car I was in, on the way to the focus test, we discussed what we expected out of the focus test. Hey, what do you think is going to happen? What are people going to like? What are people not going to like? We came to a conclusion very quickly that people were not really going to like the game because it was very early in development. They're not going to enjoy it. They're going to find it difficult. They're going to find it confusing. Maybe they'll catch glimmers of this part's cool, the gun system is kind of kicking off, and that's going to be neat. A couple of the look and style, they might like that. But we pretty much painted a picture of anticipation that said, this is not going to go over real well. The other car didn't do that. The guys in the other car just sort of asked what's going to happen. They didn't know. So we went, had the focus test. The players didn't care for the game. They thought it was difficult. They thought it was tricky. They didn't understand it. The UI wasn't in place. There were frame rate issues, all kinds of problems. The guys in our car were feeling pretty good, because we expected them to not like it very much. We found that they liked it a little more than we thought. The guys in the other car went in, and someone just told them that their baby was ugly and that they weren't very nice people and they made a bad game, and they were crushed. They were really upset, really miserable. And this is a common problem when people do focus testing. They focus test something that they have so much commitment and belief in, they become afraid. It's like a writer who refuses to show anybody the stuff he's written until it's just right. We found that was really, really important for us to We thought it was really important for you to learn to set your expectations realistically for what you get out of a focus test. And we also realized that we needed to do testing more rigorously and more regularly if we were going to avoid this sort of not only get the information we needed to make the game as good as possible, but also we needed to avoid crushing all of our designers. So we formed the Truth Team. The Truth Team was formed very quickly after this to test internally and to regularly do get usability information, and quickly Stephanie took charge.
Yes, I actually started in Gearbox in the quality assurance department. Myself and one other person from QA was pulled out to start doing user testing. One of us had a background in databases. We kind of understood how numbers relate to each other, what type of information to store. The other person in the department had a background in psychology, so he knew how to read people, how to phrase questions, what to do for us to get started with asking stuff from our users. So when we started the department, we had a desire to test, we had a game that we were developing, we had a bunch of equipment in a room, but we were missing something. We needed people We needed people to test with.
We also didn't have much money.
Yes.
It was a brand new department. We were a bit smaller at the time, and we were working on a very big, very grand game. So they were limited in resources all across the board.
Yes, we were told we could use unlimited paper from the printer to make flyers at the time. Since we hadn't done a department like this, didn't know what our budget should be, we were told to just make it as inexpensive as possible, and that's where we started. So I was a college student at the time, and between classes I had about 15 minutes, and I went and stood in the highest traffic area on campus. And I stopped every single person that walked by. Hey, man, you play games? You want to come in and do a focus test? It was very aggressive the way I was approaching people because we needed to get people in immediately. Within about 15 minutes, I had 10 names on a sheet of paper with email addresses and phone numbers. That was our first focus test. After we were recruiting at colleges, we also started going to midnight launches for games. You can find a lot of people there that are just standing around. They're obviously gamers because they're standing in line to buy a game at midnight. One of the first ones we went to was the Gears of War 2 midnight launch. There was about 150 people standing in front of a Best Buy. I went around with a laptop and a survey, and I asked every person in line, hey, do you want to take a survey for a video game that's in development? Of course they did. They're standing in line for the next 2 hours, not going anywhere.
Real quick, did you have to get approval from Best Buy to do this?
Nah, we're Gearbox. Think about it in terms of, generally speaking, eventually we become friends with the local game companies. But, when it comes down to it, if you actually have to test something, you can always go guerrilla filmmaking.
We did ask the Best Buy, hey, is it cool if we stand out here? Fortunately, the store is less than a mile from our office, so they knew most of us pretty well, and they were okay with it. So we stood in line. We asked a bunch of people to take a survey. There was about 150 people there. All of them were willing to take it, and they gave us their names, phone numbers, and email addresses. So now we've got 150 people that we can use for our tester pool. Shortly after that, we were picked up by a gaming news site. Kotaku ran a story on us because they found out that we were doing user testing, bringing people into Gearbox's office. We ended up being on the front page for about 2 days. In that 2 days, we received 1,200 applications. 500 of those people were within an hour of our office. So our tester pool very quickly grew. One thing we like to do with our testers, rather than treating them like names in a database, we treat them as part of our community. We send out surveys regularly. We stay in contact with a lot of our testers. We do things to make them feel special, make them feel like they're part of something bigger. When we bring them in, we give them swag. We give them T-shirts, keychains. It's cool stuff that you can't get anywhere else. We don't give it away at trade shows. We only give it to our testers.
The developers don't even get it. It's very sad.
They get really sad when I have T-shirts and I tell them you can't have one. They're for my testers. Something else that we do is we've invited our testers to our launch parties. We invited them to the Duke Nukem release party. We sent an email out to our entire database, which was about 6,000 people at the time, and said, hey, if you're going to be in Dallas, come to the Duke release party. We invited them 2 days before we opened it up to the general public, so they had an opportunity to register long before anyone else.
And do you do the swag instead of like the typical remuneration, like just monetary remuneration? Do you do both?
We do both. It depends on what we're testing at the time and how long they're coming in for.
We have, because Borderlands is such a long, complicated game, what we will do is we will have a long-form test, which takes place over an entire weekend or even a couple of weeks, where we bring in a small group of testers who, through continuous testing, Stephanie has identified as being particularly good at providing feedback or particularly strong understanding of games, and they'll get something. Although the first bunch of tests were what the industry calls pizza testing. Congratulations, you get a slice of pizza.
Yeah, actually, I think our first group, all we did was give them pizza and nothing else, which makes a lot of college students really happy because not only do they get lunch, but they get to see something that's not released yet that none of their friends have seen.
In the groups that you identify that give you good feedback and stuff, do you rotate those? Do you have a process? Do you continue to use the same people throughout?
It really depends on the nature of what we're testing. If we're testing something that, if we're testing a feature that someone needs an advanced knowledge of the game, we'll bring people back in. That way they already understand some of the basic concepts within it. A lot of times we'll bring in new people.
There are great advantages to having somebody who's experienced the thing and understands the game, but they're also great advantages to having somebody who's never played the game before. If you're looking for usability and just familiarity with the controller, you want to bring somebody in who's never played the game. Mm-hmm.
We also reach out through other places. I think the youngest person in our database, of course, is 18, because you have to be 18 to sign an NDA and come in. The oldest tester in our database is 62, who has actually come in and tested. We also go to other places where we know the older demographics will hang out. We've gone to office buildings. We've put ads in the paper, that kind of stuff.
Chess parks. They like games.
So, like chess.
Yeah. So now that we had testers and we've got a whole process going, we wanted to make sure that we kept a couple of things in mind. Some questions you're probably asking yourselves is, well, when should you test?
When should we test?
We started testing very early. We've tested everything from UI mock-ups that were done in a web browser, because it's much quicker to iterate on that than it is to get that in-game. We've tested scripts, had people come in and read this, ask, hey, does this make sense to you? We've tested screenshots of the game. Which one do you like better?
The first test of the art style was actually a collage of images from that other people had done. We made collages of images of other games and other things to get a general sense of what kinds of art styles there could be. But as I said earlier, I reiterate this point, it's very good to test early because it teaches you, it helps you see where you're going, it helps you see where you are, and it gets you used to the fact that, well, most of your testers are just not going to like what you have. It's a very, very rude awakening if you wait to the last minute to start testing.
And testing early gives you more time to iterate on your product. It also allows you to develop trends. You can see a larger delta between where you started and where you ended if you start testing earlier. So if you don't have testers, can you test with your coworkers?
Absolutely.
You can. But should you test with your coworkers?
Absolutely not.
You have to keep in mind with your coworkers, they will be biased, especially if you're testing someone that's working on the project you're testing. One thing that we like to do at Gearbox is we'll have the Aliens team test Borderlands 2. We'll have the Borderlands 2 team test Aliens. That way they're not directly attached and they can give more objective feedback.
You like the stuff you've worked on. Most people do. But you will find yourself attached to what you're working on. Your team will find themselves attached to what they're working on. And when you make a decision that doesn't go their way because the general public doesn't agree, but they are on the other side, you can create real rifts and real political problems within your organization. If you have no other choice, you have no other choice. But you probably have another choice. I would strongly advise against doing any testing where people test their own product. Outside of the general, I'm always testing my own product every time I load it up.
Another aspect of that is kind of the idea of getting sort of fallacies for these people that are around it every day. You're not going to see the same issues with people who have a team because they know what to do. They know how to interact with it.
Yeah, there's other things. For instance, that's actually a very good point. We'll kind of talk about that a little bit later.
And you also run into the issue of these are people you work with every day. If they say something that hurts your feelings, it can damage that relationship. And a lot of times your coworkers will be more gentle than someone you bring in from outside. They'll tell you they like it even if they hate it and it's the worst thing they've ever seen.
No, they tell me it's the worst thing they've ever seen.
A lot of our people are honest, but occasionally we get the guy who just wants to be nice. So what about confidentiality?
Okay, keep it to yourself.
Yeah, the one thing you want to make sure you do is when you're bringing people in from outside, have them sign an NDA, track every single person that comes in. The one thing you want to do is protect your intellectual property. There is nothing preventing someone from outside from coming in and stealing all of your secrets, using that to develop their own product. One thing we like to do is on our NDA, we have restrictions for eligibility. If people work in the industry, they can't test, they have to sign a different NDA, and they don't get grouped in with our regular tester pool. We make sure we screen everyone who comes in, and with social networking as popular as it is now, it's really easy to find people on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and see who works in the industry.
I think as a disclaimer, I should point out that neither Stephanie nor I are lawyers. We are giving you practical advice, yes. Not legal advice.
Yes, you want to go to a lawyer to get an NDA. It's really inexpensive when you consider how much loss you can have by not having people sign an NDA. You can go get a lawyer, have them write up the contract for you, and then use that for the remainder of your testing on that product.
Gearbox has our own lawyer.
We do, and he's pretty good. We tell everyone he's a ninja, and he'll drop down out of the ceiling and find them no matter where they're at, so don't violate the NDA. So now that we're doing testing, we need to learn how to interpret the feedback. There's a couple of things that were very clear to us to begin with, and a couple of things that took a few tests before we realized we need to keep these things in mind.
Generally speaking, things to keep in mind. There's a few things. These are sort of the rules that we've come to in terms of when Stephanie brings the information to the design team. These are certain key things that we always follow. Number one is these testers tend to speak in fact. They think they're speaking in fact, but they're actually speaking with their emotions. They tell you things that they believe are, this is the truth, this is my opinion, this is my understanding of things. You have to take whatever they say and basically reinterpret it as an emotional response to whatever they're looking at.
Yeah, they're talking about their experience, not what really exists in the game.
Yeah. The second thing is testers, they don't like features they don't understand. You will get feedback saying, this is terrible, this is awful. And the truth is, it may not be awful. It may be they just don't fully grasp what it is they're looking at or experiencing. Third point is they have expectations that may not match yours. This is, for instance, Borderlands is a game about wanting things. One of the common things we hear people say is, boy, I sure would like to build my own gun. Okay, you'll build your own gun, and you'll have the perfect gun. Now the game's over. Congratulations. The quest for the perfect gun ends when you get your own gun. So if you build your own gun in the first hour of the game's over. That's a really common bit of feedback we get. But I want to get into these just a little bit more detail here. With specific examples. Early on in development, we had some feedback about sprint speed. Stephanie, tell us what they said about sprint speed.
People were saying that it doesn't feel like they're moving very fast, that there wasn't much of a difference between walking and running speed. We got a lot of comments like this.
These are all actual quotes from our focus testing. Mm-hmm. So what I have to do is I have to interpret this data. They're saying the sprint speed is slow. But what actually is happening is the sprint speed feels slow. The sprint speed was pretty good. So how do we deal with this? We looked at the levels they were talking about this in, and we realized there wasn't a whole lot of stuff on the ground. It was like sprinting in a desert. There's no perspective shift. So one thing we did, we basically did a couple of things to fix this. We didn't change the sprint speed. We put more stuff on the ground, and we changed their FOV slightly so you got more of a sense of movement. Did you show the videos? I hope you all noticed the difference. Those were the exact same speed, the exact same area, but we had a little bit more debris and a little bit more stuff in the way in order to give you that sense of motion. After that, we stopped getting complaints about sprint speed being slow. So the second example is Second Wind. Second Wind is the down state in Borderlands. If you've played Borderlands, when you get killed, instead of going immediately to respawn, you go into a state where you're on the ground and you're... If you shoot somebody, you spring back to life. Well, early on, we hadn't yet added all the feedback information. And what were they saying about that, Stephanie?
They didn't know what to do before they died. They understood that they could fire their gun, but they didn't know what the purpose was of it. And occasionally people were reviving themselves, and they had no idea why. They were incredibly confused. This was actually one of our most common confusing comments that we got throughout testing.
This is about people not liking feedback that they don't understand, which is it. They didn't understand what was going on. They were viewing this as They were viewing this as a penalty when it was actually an opportunity. No other game had done this before. No other game had given you the chance to respawn without actually dying before. So we had to reframe it as an opportunity by providing lots of feedback, telling you what was going on, telling you that you need to fight for your life. When you recover, telling you you have a second wind, giving you a countdown timer so you understood what was going on. We also pull into third-person view so that you could have a better understanding of what just happened.
Then when you come back, you get the big splash that says second wind. You have tons of feedback. Now it's very clear what you did and what you were supposed to do.
And it has become one of the favorite features because it is an opportunity to survive, not a penalty. And all we changed was the feedback. The actual gameplay never changed. Third one was... This is an unusual bit I'm throwing in there. There's an area at the start of the game called Skag Gully, and it is one of the first areas you go in to do some combat. There's not a whole lot of required stuff to do in Skag Gully. We had people going into Skag Gully, and they weren't having a very good time.
Stephanie, what were they saying?
Oh, as they said, there were too many skags. Instead, as they were moving throughout the level, they'd encounter clusters of enemies, and there were just, you know, groups of them scattered throughout. Also, players were saying that it's not fun, it's boring. It was one of our areas that was testing the worst in level of fun and engagement for players.
So, I need to interpret the feedback. People are saying there's too many skags, all right? Well, the problem is the pacing. They were running into a small group of skags, fighting them, and then moving and running into another small group of skags. They were interpreting this as a movement area as opposed to a combat area. This is travel. Well, it's not supposed to be travel. It's supposed to be about the combat. So the solution to too many skags was add more skags. We almost tripled the number of skags in the area because people were saying there's too many skags. All the feedback says too many. We tripled it. People come back. Now it's a combat area. There's more enemy, more variety of enemies. Every time you get into combat, you stay in combat long enough to really appreciate it before you move to the next area. This is no longer a travel area. This is a battle area. After that, feedback was great. People loved it. This is counterintuitive. If you interpret everything that your testers give you as straight fact, as they know what they're talking about, our solution would have been to remove a bunch of the skags, and we would have had a game that was slightly less boring.
One way we validated our results on this is we ended up bringing back people who had given this area of combat the lowest rankings, people on a scale of 10 who were ranking it at like 2 and 3. When we brought them back in, their ratings improved significantly.
I came to that conclusion because you have to, as I said, you have to interpret what they're saying as an emotional response. Anytime you interpret what somebody says as a specific direct fact, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to sometimes fail because a lot of times they do not have all the information you have about what the game should be. I came to that conclusion from simply watching them play and realizing the pacing was really bad. They'd fight a couple of guys, move forward, fight a couple of guys, and the guys were interrupting their progress. Well, the enemies weren't the blocker. The enemies were the destination. So it really comes down from understanding that their emotional response to this pacing is bad. People don't know how to say the pacing's bad in a game. So they're interpreted as there's too many of these things in my way. They're making it hard for me to get through the boring part. Yeah.
I think
Yeah.
Yeah, and a big part of the combat loop is you kill something, guns fall out, you pick it up, you go to the next thing. Since we were missing a lot of that loop, they weren't picking up loot, they weren't engaging in combat, it was just very boring to them and felt too spread out. We understood it was a pacing issue after watching a few sessions.
Yeah, we don't have a slide for this, but real quick, there's another example that is very popular to talk about in the office. We had some feedback about reload speed. The reload speed of some of the guns was too slow. We had feedback from some of the really higher-ups in the company who were playing the game and finding reload feels way too slow. Well, we went and checked the timing of the reload of our guns and compared it against Call of Duty, which, when it comes to first-person shooter feeling good, is the benchmark. I state that as a fact as opposed to an opinion because it is. The first-person shooter Call of Duty feels great. And we realized our guns were reloading faster than theirs. Their slowest reload time was 6 or 7 seconds long. All right, why does ours feel slow? We realized, well, our reload is this. It's a big, heavy machine gun. You flip up the thing, pull the ammo, plug it in, flop it over, flip it down, shoot. So what we did was we added a charging handle. So I pump the charging handle, then I flip the thing up, then I pull the chain, then I pull it down, then I pump the charging handle again. We added more activity for the hands. So the player reloads, they see more stuff going on, and then we slowed the reload down slightly more before we would take it back to those people to test it again. And they said, oh, this is much faster. We actually made it slower. It was about their experience. They're discussing their emotional response to the experience. And this applies even when they're in the UI, even when they're dealing with clicking through the HUD. This is something that Apple's very good about. This is why Apple often defeats PC because they're all about the tactile response. Their tactile response time on their equipment is fantastic. because they're understanding that it's about that experience. We should continue. So early on in the game, right before Skagoli is a bunch of side quests. There's a section where we wanted you to... your main quest says, go fight this guy named Bonehead. So you go to fight Bonehead. And what were people saying, Stephanie?
Well, they interpreted as they were saying that they were feeling the boss was too difficult. He was a bullet sponge. It was actually a very common comment that we got. They were taking too much ammo, couldn't kill him with the means that they had. A few weeks later into testing on this combat, they started saying that the skull shows that they can't kill him. So they interpreted that as, I can't kill this guy. What do I do?
So our interpretation is they were getting... you moved way forward. They were frustrated because they were testing something. But the truth is, this was by design. We wanted them to get frustrated fighting him, and we wanted them to back out and go do something else. Our game has primary quests, and it also has side quests, and you're really not going to succeed unless you do some side quests. So we realized that at some point we had to put a stake in the ground and tell the player, you have to go do a side quest to continue. But it had to be an optional quest, because once you make it a critical path, it's no longer a side quest. The solution was, we're going to make an enemy, we're going to give him a ridiculous gun, we're going to make him really strong. Bonehead had a gun called the Bone Shredder that fired multiple bullets at the same time. And there was no long-range combat solution for him. You had to get close, and he was going to kill you unless you were a higher level. So we gave you a lot of side quests, and then immediately sent you to Bonehead so that you would go fight him, find it frustrating, go do the side quests. This was by design. The thing we changed was that little skull in the top corner. We added the skull to tell you this is a dangerous enemy, which is why that feedback came back later on. That's all we did. You're frustrated. We want you to be frustrated. Sometimes the players, much like, I want to be able to build my own gun. Oh, good. It's good to want things. Sometimes the player's frustration or sometimes the user's annoyance with something is by design. A good example is, hey, you need to click this giant long legal document before you can update your latest whatever. And it says, I agree. Well, I don't think that document is really, really, really long because, oops, they forgot how to type. That's kind of, they don't want you to read that. They just want you to agree to it. Okay, that's good design on their part because you're not going to read all that stuff. You're just going to agree to whatever they said. If they kept that short and easy to read, then you might actually read it. Ooh.
So a little bit about our results from testing Borderlands. I've got a chart here demonstrating what our scores were over time. We ran 39 weeks worth of testing.
These are the internal test scores.
Mm-hmm. So over the course of 12 months, we started with a score of a 4.5 on our first test that we did internally. We ran a total of 173 sessions across 39 weeks. We saw over 680 people. At the end, we ended up with an 8.5 as our average score. We were consistently getting those scores with our last few samples that we ran, so we were confident that we had addressed as many of the issues as we could before the game needed to ship.
I think it's important to note that Borderlands, from early on, one of the first rules we decided was we're not making a game for everybody. We're making a game for the hardcore player. We're making a game for a really special group of people. We're hoping that other people enjoy it, trying to keep it accessible. We were not ever anticipating or expecting, you know, 9.5 or 10 scores out of this game. We really wanted a game that some people would love, not everybody would like.
Something else I'd like to note here is that currently we've got over 10,000 people in our database to pull from for focus testers. We've got 2,000 people just within 25 miles of where our office is located. All of that has been done through advertising at college campuses, the news stories that have picked us up through the Dallas Morning News and some other local papers.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth is really big for us because a lot of our testers come in and have a great time. They can't say what they tested or their opinion about it, but we tell them they can tell their friends if they enjoyed it. Most people enjoy it and they want to come back. We often get emails from our testers asking, hey, I haven't been in 6 months. Did you forget about me? Do I need to reapply? Because they want to come back and see us again. They enjoy participating in this process. So currently, we're applying the things that we've learned to testing Borderlands 2. Since we've had some experience testing within the Borderlands franchise, we had a good understanding of what player expectations were going into it. One thing I'd like to note, and I probably shouldn't say too much about this, is that our scores have been much higher with our initial sets of testing than with the first Borderlands. We knew what a lot of the problems were before we started development on this, and we went in wanting to address some of the major complaints that we still had towards the end of the project. Yes? Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of bias. There's people who come in and they test weapons that are untextured at this point in development, and they're like, 10, everything's a 10, it's perfect, don't change anything. We know those guys are biased because of the feedback they gave.
We have testers come in and say, so where's Sledge's shotgun? Yeah. It's a sequel, you may not find Sledge's shotgun. Like, well, we'd like to find Sledge's shotgun.
do you make sure that you get...
Yes. Some of the demographic information we collect on our tester application is what games you've played recently. We also send out updates to people asking them to update their demographics. That way, if someone didn't buy Borderlands a year ago but has picked it up since then, we know that they've picked it up. It's difficult to find people internally who with our database who haven't played Borderlands. Sometimes we'll reach out to recruiting agencies and they'll do cold calls for us and send us a list of people so we know that these guys haven't played. Occasionally, we do get a person who comes in who was a huge fan of Brothers in Arms or is really looking forward to Aliens, knows nothing about Borderlands, didn't even know the first game existed. And we make sure that we test with both groups because we want to keep our fans happy, but we also want to encourage new players to get into the franchise. And a lot of the things that we learned on Borderlands we apply to our other products. We're testing Aliens Colonial Marines. That supports drop-in, drop-out co-op, similar to what Borderlands did. So a lot of the lessons we learned with usability from co-op, getting into games, we're applying that to this project. Similar concept with us testing Brothers in Arms Furious 4. This game also has a lot of the kind of Borderlands feel. It's very over-the-top combat, very different flavor of combat than what the original Brothers in Arms was. And one of our challenges with this is people come in knowing what Borderlands was. People know what Brothers in Arms was. This feels very different to them than what the previous Brothers in Arms games did. So, do you guys have any other questions for us? So with that particular data point, we ask them to rate the game on a scale of 1 to 10, and we tell them before they rate the game, pretend that I'm an employee at GameStop, and I just charged you $60 for this game. It's surprising that just making a statement like that will change the scores. A lot of people will say, oh, I know you're going to fix all of these issues. It's going to be a 9 when it comes out. If you tell them, if you frame the question as, you just paid $60 for this, oh, well, it's actually a 6 if you're charging me money. Yes.
I'm concerned, or my interest is really in like the process, this iterative process of going out and getting the feedback, taking it, interpreting the results, and then saying, okay, what are your next moves? How long does that take? And like, are there like aha heated arguments? Of, like, how do you come up with this interpretation that says, no, this is what they mean? They really mean that.
So with a lot of our testing, there's several ways that we collect information. We'll have them fill out surveys. That way we get one-on-one feedback. We'll also do individual interviews to prevent groupthink. We do a discussion at the end. We also collect statistics through the game. A lot of the statistics we can compare to other things. If we have a tester say that... For example, the enemy's too difficult, I keep running out of ammo. If we find out they've only picked up 50 bullets in the last 20 minutes that they've been playing, we know that it's likely a problem with the amount of ammo they have. Could also be a problem with the guns that are dropping. Maybe they're not getting high enough level weapons to go in and engage in the combat that they're in.
Well, that's one of the advantages to having the internal team and doing frequent testing. If we have a real argument, generally speaking, a lot of these problems can be solved simply by going through the process of what are they really feeling, what are the real emotions here, and watching them do it. But if we come to a point where we're not sure which way to solve a problem, if feasible, we test it both ways. We don't always have time to test it both ways, and there are some decisions where you have to make a call, at which point you need to... One of the strong advantages of having ongoing testing and ongoing processes, you start to learn the people who are good at interpreting the data, and you figure out who in your organization is really good at solving these problems and understanding what this feedback is. The whole SCAG goalie thing of increasing the number of SCAGs is, as was stated earlier, kind of counterintuitive. When you find someone who's able to make those kind of calls and it turns out right, you give them a little bit extra listen and pay attention. If you find someone who is a smart, good guy, but sometimes has trouble interpreting the data and understanding how they should move forward, then they need to start to recognize that maybe that isn't their forte. It's a different kind of thing. We have some people who are really good at designing the initial product and designing the initial content or gameplay, and then have real difficulty letting go of that so that they can look at it fresh and take it somewhere else. You have to be able to look at your own work from an outsider perspective, interpret it from an outsider perspective.
And there was a lot of internal argument about which solution is right with SCAG goalie. A lot of people were saying, no, take enemies out. Players say that's what they want. Give them what they want. There were some people who disagreed with it. We made the call to test more SCAGs. When we tested that, we got the better results. We understood that that was the better decision.
So it's a combination of, like, some of it's gut, some of it's just more testing, more data, but having that balance between, you know, having the
right tests. One of the reasons that Truth was formed was to get rid of arguments. And one of the main things was, if we build this, when we get into the argument about how should this design go, it's evidence. It's not proof, but it's evidence to support a position. If somebody's, like I said, you can quickly learn if you test frequently enough that somebody's really consistently good at solving the right problem and making the right decisions, whether design decisions or UI decisions or whatever. You can also quickly learn general, you can also say, hey, if you have an argument with somebody and you can't solve it, you take it to Truth, give them two different problems, and try to test them both and see which one works.
And we've done a lot of that testing with certain things like the functionality of camera and how it follows your character. We've done that with FOV settings. People were saying that weapons felt really big. We adjusted the FOV because that makes the weapon appear like it's shorter. We didn't change anything about the weapon, but doing something as simple as let's tweak the FOV, see what it does. That got us results that were a lot better than if we had gone in and redone the model, retextured it, gone through all the work of remaking the entire gun.
You were heading straight up next.
So it sounds like that sort of digesting the feedback you're getting is actually a little counterintuitive a lot of times. You were saying people were saying the guns were too slow, but the speed of the response being efficient, the player was getting a feedback that it felt right rather than the actual terms of raw seconds ticking by. People were saying, you know, too many SCAGs, so you added more SCAGs before it felt right.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, I'm curious, was there any feedback you got that you could either just sort of take at face value, or people were saying this feature is terrible, you have to cut it, and you actually cut it to work better, or did you have to really do a lot of sort of digesting and massaging to make sure the feedback you're getting is actually useful and actually made the game better rather than
Sometimes people's emotion is dead on. Sometimes people say it's too hard, and the reason they say it's too hard is because it's too hard. But it's not necessarily, their emotions aren't wrong, but you have to recognize that they don't have all the data, they don't have all the information, and they're speaking from an emotional base. Once you interpret their emotion, the emotion of this feels slow was exactly right. It did feel slow. But the trick is not interpreting it as this is slow. You interpret it as an emotional response, and you're able to react to it differently. SCAG goalie. This feels like there's too many SCAGs. No. This feels boring. This feels pacing odd. Once you pull it down to the emotions they're experiencing, then it's a lot easier for you to interpret it correctly.
Yes, you had your hand up in the back. We also do some marketing-based questions. We'll ask about purchase intent. A lot of times the people who say, no, I wouldn't buy this game. Absolutely not. We'll bring them back in 6-8 months later in the process and ask if their feelings have changed. We'll also ask why. Sometimes they'll say they would buy the game now because all of the things that they felt were wrong with it the first time they came in and tested have been addressed, and it's a good game now. Sometimes it's marketing that does that. They saw a trailer and it made the game look even cooler than what their experience was when they came in and played it. We collect all of that information, and it is time-consuming to go through all of that. We get a lot of written feedback. In a week worth of testing, we get probably 10,000 to 12,000 words in written feedback, and we have a department that goes through all of that. We read every single comment that we get and try to figure out if they're actually, you know, saying something that is important to them, or if the feedback is really something that we shouldn't take into consideration. An example of that is we had a guy come in and say that the default resolution of the 360 was outputting in something that's not native for that console. Totally confusing comment. We looked at it. We tried to understand what he was trying to tell us. He was trying to tell us that a texture was stretched on a box. It was incredibly confusing, and if we tried to analyze that comment based on the actual words that he said, we would have been just off. We went back, looked at the game. Oh, a couple of textures are showing incorrect on the boxes. Maybe that's what he was talking about.
You know, we actually get a lot of feedback from people who are trying to say something and they don't understand our intent. We got some feedback about our economy in the first game that it was, I have too much money. But the truth is, the goal of the economy in the first game was to be a patch for you didn't find the gun you wanted, so you're going to go buy it. So we kind of gave you too much. We erred to the side of too much money in the first game because all the good stuff's out in the world. But if you're desperate for a good new gun, or your shield hasn't even, we haven't dropped a new shield in a long time, we can either build a behind-the-scenes trick to drop the thing you want, or we can make sure you have enough money to go buy one.
Yeah, and in a game like Borderlands, where we have millions and millions of items to choose from, it's really difficult to handle that on the back end, so we left that up to player choice in a lot of places for that with the economy.
Anyone else? Yeah.
So one of the kind of stuff we're talking about figuring out the solution, I think the way I captured my mind is making a distinction between what the issue is and why it's an issue, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. where the interpretation comes in. So, like you said, it's not practice emotion. You can't say that as word. You have to really look at it in context and figure out why it's causing the problem. So I think the more static idea is brilliant. Different than what you would think. So just a note on that, but my question is, in terms of your methodology and initial few things, you talk about kind of focus stuff, which I would assume is more group-based, and you talk about kind of focused interviews, which is kind of more one-on-one. Mm-hmm. We also include things like just one-on-one straight testing where somebody comes in, just one person comes in, plays a game, they have feedback, or do you usually work in more of a group
space? Generally speaking, this is one of the reasons we refer to it as usability testing as opposed to simply focus testing. A focus test has a technical terminology that is too narrow for what Stephanie does. I will let you elaborate on that.
And so a lot of times we'll have people come in and do one-on-one testing and have them interact with the UI. We'll ask them, you know, do you understand the story? That type of testing, we tend to get better results with individuals. Overall feeling of the game and just general testing, we like to do that with groups. Our testing facility will hold up to 10 people at a time, and it's big enough to house the discussion in there. We've also got smaller rooms that we can use for the one-on-one testing and interviews. We do a lot of different stuff with collecting data on the back end so that we can confirm what people are saying. Sometimes they'll say, I couldn't find any guns. Nothing was dropping. But our log shows that 200 weapons dropped for them in the 30 minutes that they were playing. So we can go back and confirm our results with that and kind of compare that to what they're doing. And we also have developers come in and directly observe the sessions. If a level designer wants to see how people are playing their map, we'll invite them to come sit in the session. They'll watch people play. Sometimes they'll come in several times during the week, watch up to 30 or 40 people play their map, then go back and make changes based on what they've observed.
And one of the things that I personally enjoy doing, especially in the first Borderlands, less so this time, is showing up as a focus tester,
yeah.
So that I can listen to all the stuff, because as with the very opening scene, they're biased. Opening moment when she asks you, do you like Borderlands? You don't want to say anything rude about Borderlands in front of the guy. If you hate this game, that's great. I'm glad you hate it. I'm glad you hate Jacobs. It's the worst gun. You hate it. Good. That was one of the goals. You'll hate it worse this time, but you'll love one of the others. The but sitting in on a test quietly, one of the difficulties of focus testing that Stephanie has to deal with is people are coming to Gearbox. That sort of, there's an ingrained sort of, oh, we're going to Gearbox to test the game. And as soon as they show up, anyone who's a fan is already set and excited. They've got some adrenaline in them. They're looking forward to it. They're anticipating Borderlands 2. They're a big fan. So, you know, that sort of goes to the question that someone asked earlier, which was we have to deal with the fact that people are biased by their knowledge of us. There's basic methodology rules that I think any focus tester or any focus test will tell you, which is don't let them talk too much about the game or anything else before the thing starts. Once they're finished, make sure they write down their opinions first, because when they get into the conversation point, someone's going to say, you know what, I hated those Jacob's Gun, and everybody in this room is going to just latch on to that.
And when we do the group testing, we tell them ahead of time, make sure you keep your headphones on. That way you can't hear anything that's going on in the room if the moderator has to whisper something to someone else in the session. We also ask them to refrain from making comments directly about the game, because as soon as someone says, oh, this thing sucks, everybody else turns and looks at their screen, and now the entire room thinks that it sucks, when it's something that, you know, 9 out of 10 people would have never noticed on the screen if it hadn't been pointed out.
Yes.
You're talking about using screenshots and collages and stuff for when it's too early to show the gameplay. Did you guys do that for Borderlands or what? You know, talk about the art style when that came out.
We did some user testing on that. We were more curious what the reaction was going to be. Internally, we felt that changing the art style was the correct decision for us. The reason we did testing on that was to kind of understand what the reaction was. When we did the testing, we showed, you know, A and B screenshots. Here's the same thing. This is the old, this is the new art style. People seem to like both the more realistic art style we originally had and then the more stylized one equally. The thing that made the more stylized one stand out to us is people were giving more colorful comments about it. They said it stood out more, it was more distinct, it was something they would remember longer, it was more identifiable. So we knew that it was the right decision to make that change.
Yes, sir.
So when you guys were testing for Borderlands, the game itself, do you guys also try to utilize those testers to kind of test other things in the brand, websites or mobile apps or any advertising or that? Like, since they're already there, do you guys try to get their experiences on those other platforms or other places where they can view the game, or is it just only focused on the game?
We have done some of that. Before we put the intro movie into the game, we ran tests just on the intro to see if it gave any context, what their expectations were on gameplay based solely on the intro movie. We also screen all of our trailers before we release them to get some feedback.
Could you say something about the music and the soundtrack? I mean, how that's selected, sourced, I mean, getting the talent, the voice, and, you know, how that syncs in with the programmers, developers?
Would you like to say something about that?
We do. Our department works very closely with our audio team to make sure that it conveys the feeling of combat that they're wanting to get out of it. Borderlands tends to have a very distinct style of music in it. It's kind of, I don't even know how you would describe that.
It's sort of an aboriginal kind of feel on top of a something. I don't,
it's very it's nice. Different than what you expect from most first-person shooters. We make sure that the feeling that people get in combat is at least in line with the emotions that audio expects them to get. As long as they feel engaged and they don't say the music is bad, usually that's a good sign. And audio is one of the hardest things to test for. You can't ask someone, how does it sound to you? Because they're like, oh, music, great, yeah, it's music. You kind of have to get that feedback indirectly about it. Do you feel that combat pacing is correct? If they say yes or no, you go back and look. Well, is it enemy count? Is there something else? Oh, there's no combat music. Maybe that's why they feel it's not as engaging.
There's an old filmmaker rule that says if somebody complains about the lighting in your movie, your sound's bad. We have the same sort of thing. If somebody says, this gun's not powerful enough, it's probably the sound. It's probably has nothing to do with how much damage it does. It just doesn't sound good enough. So that's one of those things where you sort of have to interpret. People don't talk about sound. We hit the music pretty early on and stuck with it pretty consistently. All of our cast are local. We have local voice actors because there's a good talent pool around this area. A couple of them are at South by Southwest wandering around. But it's also convenient because when we test, if something's, if people aren't understanding some bit of story, we can bring them back in very quickly and do a quick pickups.
Yeah, I just comment. When the first original trailer came out with the theme soundtrack, I mean, that painted as much to me as what the game was and what it's going to be.
Ain't No Rest for the Wicked, that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the guys at Gearbox was, we were trying to find a sound for it, because all the trailers and things we do are done internally at Gearbox. We don't go to almost all of them. But they're mostly done internally at Gearbox, and we were looking for the right song that really captured the song, and someone heard it on the Adventure Club on the Edge. So that's where we get our music from. We just listen to the radio and try to find it. We have similar sort of search going on very recently for Borderlands 2.
What's your question?
You said that at one point that you went back and looked at the logs, and the logs said that this guy had got like 20 gun dropping.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to know how we fixed that?
My question is, like, how do you combine this sort of logging or digital testing with human testing?
We'll have our programmers go in and put hooks in the game for certain things, like number of bullets fired, number of times the player dies, how many times they get a second wind. And then we'll go back and we'll read through all of the feedback that they've given to us verbally or in written form. After we read through that and we have an understanding of what they've perceived, we'll go back later and compare that to the actual data that we've collected. And in the example of weapons, the guy said that nothing dropped. Well, we interpret that as one of two things. Either the weapons that dropped he didn't see, so he didn't pick them up, because the game says that this many things came out of enemies. The other thing is maybe he didn't find the gun that he wanted. Maybe he really wanted a rocket launcher, and none of those guns were rocket launchers.
So here's how I interpret that one. Players have something called the 20-yard stare. The average player playing a video game, and when I say this, you're all going to know it's true, looks at the ground 20 yards in front of them. If you put something important up in the air, they're not going to see it. If you put something important really far down, they're not going to see it. That's what they're looking at. They're looking at that man's feet back there whenever they play a game. Almost all players follow this pattern. Their crosshair's right there until they need to shoot someone in the head. And even if their crosshair's up, their eyes are down there. This is how you are in real life. You're probably observing the ground ahead of you. So the solution was we added a shaft of light to every item. It was very quick. It's shaped like this so that it draws your eyes down. And we made sure that light reflects the color of the rarity of the item. So a really rare item, there's this green shaft of light floating in front of you. You see that thing, you follow the line down because it runs at the bottom, and there's your item. And we also had the item card pop up really big on your screen immediately. So, it was as simple as adding a small shaft of light, and people suddenly understood that they were supposed to be picking up the guns on the ground. Sometimes the best solution is what we call an elegant solution. It's something that's very simple but addresses all the issues immediately. That'll teach you. Okay. Well, we're almost out of time. Is there anything else? Yes.
Do you find that you're a victim of your success? Like, you started this with the problem that you were underfunded relative to the size of the project that you had to do, and you start out with this grassroots, at the college campus or Best Buy, collecting this database of users. Now the next game, you go back to where your budget guys say, okay, well, you did usability testing for this much,
Here's a rule for IT. Anyone who knows anything about IT, if you don't know the name of your IT professional, give him a raise. Okay. If you've never met him, everything just works. You never had to call him on the phone. Everything. Figure out who he is and give him a raise. You don't want to lose him. If you know your IT professional really, really well, that's the problem. It's sort of the same thing. That's kind of the victim of your own success scenario. So I think there's some appreciation for what the truth has brought to this game. I'm director, lead designer. I tell you, this game would not have succeeded the way it did without Stephanie and her team. She doesn't get the big, giant standing ovation, and people don't want get signatures from her, and she gets very shy when I say this. But that's part of the reason why I like to do things like this. I get an opportunity to come to Southwest. I'm bringing Stephanie. We're putting her on a pedestal for a minute because she's a huge part of what made Borderlands good. And she is a huge part of what's making Borderlands 2 great.
They're a little nicer when I ask for more T-shirts, but they still ask, do you really need 1,000 T-shirts for the next couple of months?
We asked for T-shirts before we came here. Where's Matt Charles? T-shirts. We're almost out of time.
So we do
this is Matt Charles. He's one of the producers at Gearbox, and he is another part of the reason why Borderlands is successful. Yes, before we came, we did actually ask for some T-shirts. We're going to be talking about goodies and swag and T-shirts and giveaways. I know South by Southwest isn't really about giving swag to people who come to a panel and want professional feedback, but we do have some T-shirts here if anybody would like one. All right. Well, those who want T-shirts, I cannot guarantee everyone gets one, so mob each other and punch each other in the head. This is the loader. It's the robot from Borderlands 2. These are Borderlands 2 T-shirts, and there are not very many of them in the world. We have extra larges and a couple of larges. That's it. Thank you, everybody.